From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Harsh words from Kiev and elsewhere about the elections held this past Sunday in eastern Ukraine. We have this report from RT.
Voters across eastern Ukraine have made their decisions and chosen their leaders. The self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk republics have been striving for greater autonomy, refusing to recognize the current Kiev authorities. For months, the area has been enduring the army's crackdown on anti-government forces. But despite sporadic fire, hundreds of thousands still turned out to cast their ballot. Well, in the Luhansk People's Republic, its incumbent prime minister, who won the election with 63%, former military commander Igor Plotnitsky had served locally as the defence minister there before being appointed as head of the region's government. In the Donetsk People's Republic, the incumbent leader there, Alexander Zakharchenko, also stays after getting 75% of the vote. He also served as a military commander of the regional capital. Then in August, he was appointed prime minister there. There's been harsh reaction, though, from Kiev. For more on that, let's go now to RT's Paula Sleer. Paula, what has the president been saying?
Well, Kiev has said that it will never recognize these elections. The Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, is now considering cancelling the law on self-determination that he gave to the eastern regions just a little over a month ago. He says that these elections were in breach of the Minsk agreement that was reached in September. And he says, according to that agreement, these elections were supposed to be held under Ukrainian law. However, he does say that he is prepared to reach a new agreement on self-governance with the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics, but only if they cancel these elections. He says that that new agreement will include details on a new budget and also redrawing the borders of these regions. Luhansk and Donetsk have issued a joint statement in which they have responded to these comments. They say that they are fully committed to the Minsk Accord and that they are ready for dialogue only if Kiev acts sensibly. At the same time, they also say that Kiev did agree to their conditions prior to the Minsk agreement and that these conditions are what they're acting in accordance with. Now, the elections did see a huge turnout here in the eastern regions. People queued for hours. The voting has now been completed. The election was hailed by international observers as reaching international standards and being of a high and transparent standard.
Okay, thanks, Paula. That's RT's Paula Sleer live there from Donetsk in the east of Ukraine. Well, for more reaction to Kiev's statements there and the elections in the east of Ukraine, let's talk to Derek Munro from the Foreign Policy and Focus think tank. He joins us now. Thanks very much for coming onto the programme. Look, is the situation retrievable? Because the two sides here, Kiev and the republics in the east of Ukraine, appear to be growing further apart, not closer together.
Well, I think political situation is developing itself in a way where everybody try to lose, basically save the face. Poroshenko government is basically calling the Ukrainian law as the most predominant factor while determining the future of the eastern part of Ukraine, notwithstanding their own credibility have taken a great hit when the revolution took place and established the elected, you know, and basically deposed regularly elected president that was replaced before. So it's a matter of simply interpretation of what the laws say and how things are going to be going forward. Yes, there's definitely a danger of impasse in a situation where we can actually go to the status quo before the Minsk agreement. But as you can also, as your reporters stated earlier, the elections have taken very much their own very popular course, with the overwhelmingly majority population voting in the east, while the elections in Kiev were only frequented by about 20% of population.
Sure. Derek, that's all very well, but people might ask the question, was it wise to go ahead with these elections in the east of Ukraine now, given that the Minsk peace agreement was only signed, you know, weeks ago? Have they really given peace a chance? They must have known this would have inflamed the authorities in Kiev.
Well, I think there are a lot of different things going on in the background. First of all, I think Poroshenko also has to kind of look at its own political situation, specifically with the different machinations and mechanisms being put in place to establish its own government, specifically with a lot of different influences from the private sector and other different parties which are making up his coalition government. So surely this can be a posturing, but I think I would be a little bit more optimistic on this side, because I think the country has to get to the degree of creating some kind of degree of peace and stability in the region, because winter is coming. People have taken a very hard hit in standard of living, as well as the stability of the area itself. So going back to the status quo before the Minsk agreement, with presumption of taking a war path, would not be productive towards anything. It would basically bring the country further into the catastrophe. Okay. So I believe that...
Sure. Well, let's just talk about a positive point there, Derek, because you mentioned that winter is coming. At least the two sides do appear to have agreed on something economically, and that's the buying of coal from the east of Ukraine to be sold to other parts of Ukraine, obviously with the winter in mind. I mean, how much of a good sign is that? Is that a good building block, a good foundation for peace?
I think it is, because ultimately the both sides have to kind of realize they really cannot, at least at this point, live without each other, and they all interdependent economically, not to mention politically. So I think right now there is definitely a lot of posturing to the degree of breaking up relations and going back to the war path, because there are a lot of different dynamics that are taking place behind closed doors, because everybody simply at the end of the day wants to save face and wants to pretend to be in charge. But I think both sides have to be really well represented. And I think the major flaws in the Kiev election, which just took place just recently, was that Easter was simply not represented and people were not allowed to vote because of the current political makeup in Kiev. So I think this is something that I think is growing organically. What is going to transfer as a quote-unquote competitive source of power towards the Kiev government, it's really hard to tell at this point. But I think I hope that things will basically get back to normal.
Mexico is moving up to a modern high-speed rail system, and it will be built by China. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
After having built the world's most extensive high-speed rail network at home, China first began exporting its rail technology back in 2009. The deal just clinched in Mexico. China's first railway project in Latin America is just the latest in the string of bids Chinese rail companies have secured abroad. The completion in July of a high-speed railway line in Turkey that links the capital Ankara to its commercial hub of Istanbul marked the first high-speed railway project that China helped complete outside its borders. Another line in Saudi Arabia agreed back in 2009, which will connect Mecca and Medina, is set to launch late next year. And an Italian order signed with Chinese train maker SCR in late 2013 marks the entrance of Chinese high-speed rail technology into the European market. Meanwhile, China has reached agreements with Russia, Thailand, Laos, Romania, Hungary, and Serbia to jointly build high-speed rails, with Chinese engineers already at work in those countries. China also hopes to take part in Britain's drive to build high-speed rail lines and other potential projects being proposed in Africa.
Although progress is being made in getting treatment to people in West Africa stricken by the Ebola outbreak, bringing the virus's rampage to a complete halt may not yet be possible. Stephanie Castro reports from the United Nations.
Progress has been made in controlling the Ebola outbreak in Liberia, but vigilance is still needed as the West African country continues to deal with the health crisis caused by the disease. That's according to Anthony Banbury, the head of the UN Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, UNMIR. Approximately 5,000 people have died of Ebola, and more than 10,000 others have been infected with the virus in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Speaking in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, on Tuesday, Mr. Banbury said some significant improvements have been made, including decreasing transmission rates and fewer deaths. But he urged caution.
We just need to now stay vigilant, not for a moment let our guard down. We can't for even a second think that everything is okay or that we're out of the crisis. We're most certainly not out of the crisis. There are still people getting Ebola in this country. There are still people dying from it. It's covering a broad geographic area. And as the medical professionals will tell you, it's going to be extremely difficult to get it down to zero.
Mr. Banbury said that he would be returning to New York to brief the General Assembly and the Security Council on Monday next week. Stephanie Castro, United Nations.
Tuesday was Election Day in the U.S., with midterm elections that could put control of the Senate in Republican hands for the final 2 years of President Obama's term. And as the various talking heads around the U.S. media treat the balloting as if it were a football game, imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal reminds us who will be the winners and who will be the losers.
Who wins? Who loses? Elections are underway, and thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United case, billions of dollars are flooding previously small and uninteresting elections in states, governorships, and Congress. Pundits are in heaven, predicting which way the polls will go, but in truth, no one knows for sure. Perhaps the Republicans will win, perhaps the Dems. The question is, will you? The answer is, at best, doubtful. For both parties are corporate-owned, and they serve those who can afford their services, and that ain't regular folks. In a classic study of political timidity, most Democrats are in full flight in running from President Barack Obama, giving his polling in the low 40s. What makes you think they won't betray you if, after two presidential elections, he brought them to the party? But guess who they won't betray? Big corporate funders, big business. Speaking of big business, here is one big winner in the election: the corporate media. For them, it's Christmas time, New Year's, and Rosh Hashanah rolled into one. But for you, for average people, have you really won? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
About 10:15, a group of demonstrators came in front of the building, in front of the embassy compound, and they walked in.
They walked in?
They actually
walked
in.
Did anyone try to stop them?
No, I don't believe so.
Because?
They said that they just wanted to stage a sit-in, and
what
they didn't want
next?
To harm anyone. They came in front of the chancellery. We saw them through the window. They had a banner saying, "We don't want to harm anyone. We just want to stage a sit-in."
How did the people at the embassy react to that, the guards?
We were taken on the second floor, maximum security floor, and we were given tear gas masks, and we were told to stay calm.
What happened after that?
A couple of hours went by, and we heard a siren. When I asked one of the Marines what had happened, they said that they had stormed the building.
They, meaning the students?
The students, yes.
They what came happened, inside the building. What happened after that?
Well, they came behind the door where we were held, and they said, if you all get out, and if you don't resist, we will not harm anyone, and we just want to stage a sit-in, and we just want to ask a couple of questions. So they came in, the Marines opened the door, and they came in, and they took all of us, blindfolded us, tied our hands behind our backs, and they took us.
Did any of you try to resist?
No, none of us.
Were any shots fired during the takeover?
No, just tear gas canisters.
Were any of the students armed?
No, none of them were armed. A couple of them had sticks.
Were there any fights?
No, no scuffles, no fights.
No scuffles between the U.S. Embassy personnel?
No, everything was calm.
That was the voice of a young Iranian translator, an employee of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, when, on November 4th, 1979, an unarmed group of Iranian students occupied the embassy in a protest against a decision by the Carter administration to admit the deposed Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, into the U.S. Pahlavi was wanted in Iran to face charges of crimes against humanity, including the murder and torture of thousands of political opponents during his 26-year rule after he deposed the elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in a U.S.-backed coup in 1953. The students' occupation of the embassy lasted more than 14 months until January 20th, 1981, the day that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as president. Within 10 days of the occupation, on November 14th, 1979, President Jimmy Carter signed Executive Order 12170, freezing all Iranian assets held within the United States and setting a course of conflict and confrontation between the two countries that still persists 35 years later. Although widely portrayed in the Western media as the Iran hostage crisis, in Iran the occupation is known as the conquest of the American spy den, given the large number of official documents found in the embassy detailing U.S. intelligence operations both in support of the Shah and in opposition to the new revolutionary government. The event is widely celebrated each year in Iran and this year was no exception. But this year there was an additional memorial being celebrated in Iran. Tuesday also marked the day of the martyrdom of the founder of Shia Islam, Husayn ibn Ali, better known as Imam Hussein, who was killed for opposing another foreign invader, Yazid I, in 680 AD. Because the day is memorialized according to the old Persian calendar, the date on the Western calendar varies from year to year. This year, both dates fall on the same day, which is highly unusual, and so the mood in Iran was doubly solemn. For more, we speak with Mustafa Afzalzadeh, an Iranian journalist who spoke with us from Tehran Tuesday. Today is the 35th anniversary of the occupation of the U.S. Embassy by the students in Tehran, and my understanding is it's also it's a double whammy. There's another similar event being celebrated today in Tehran. You want to talk about that first?
Yes. Today is the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of the Shiite Muslims. He is the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. In this day, Imam Hussein with his family, they traveled to Karbala, and they wanted to go and help the Muslims that they invited Imam Hussein to their city, but the enemies of the Imam Hussein, they stopped Imam Hussein and his family, and they killed all the men and took the women and the children as hostage. Today is very important for the Muslims, for the Shiite Muslims, because of the fight of Imam Hussein. The culture of martyrdom and the culture of resistance comes from this Imam. And when you see the resistance in the region, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, like the Iraqi fighters and the Iranians, you would see they have learned the resistance and fight from Imam Hussein. Today was the also anniversary of the hostage taking, the occupying of the U.S. embassy, and these two important things happening in one day made to this year's ceremonies very, very special.
You were born after the revolution and after the period of the occupation of the embassy.
Yes.
And you have lived essentially with the United States treating Iran as an enemy and having to deal with that on the ground. Could you talk about that? First of all, how do the people in Iran view what happened at the American embassy?
People in Iran, most of them, not all of them, there are people affected by the satellite channels and internet. But most of the people in Iran, they don't see any trust towards United States. Every year, and as it goes on, we see new things. For example, you're friends with someone, or there is another person in front of you that you had attention before, but he changes what he does and his behavior, and then he builds trust, and you can be friends again. But this is not the case with the United States. Every year we see new tension, new conflict from United States towards Iran. One of the biggest things that I have experienced myself, I haven't experienced the time of the U.S. embassy, occupying U.S. embassy, but I have experienced the 2009 presidential elections. The time that now that I'm working on an investigative report about it, I see that from 2006, the U.S. government, by building two new offices in Pentagon and in the Foreign Ministry, they started building up
a new fight with Iranians, you know, and that happened 3 years after in the presidential elections. So I don't see any trust from the United States, because, you know, I've heard from before, and I have seen things with my own eyes in the past years.
Right. Have you visited apparently there's a museum at one of the old Savak torture chambers, essentially. Have you visited that?
Yes, I've visited there, and I've took many of my foreign friends, especially from United States, that they come to Iran, and I've took them there as well.
Well, maybe you could describe it a little bit.
Well, there is a jail. There are two important things. You know, one is the embassy itself, that they've made it as a museum that people can go and visit. I guess this is the only place, only U.S. embassy that people can go and visit without any difficulty.
Right.
And they could see all the equipment for spying on Iran and also other countries in the region. So all the equipment is there for people to see. And there is another place, a jail. It's near there. It's not far. It's like 10 minutes. There is a jail that was especially for Savak, you know, for detaining the officials and people who were involved in the revolution. Like one of the people that was detained there was the Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran now. And you could see all forms of torture there that they did. And there is an old man that he was tortured there, and he is like the tour guide of there. And he gives all his memories that what happened, who came, and what they did. The people who tortured, you know, they were trained in by the Israelis and Americans to know how to torture and how to suppress the revolution. And it's very shocking, you know, when you go there and see. It's very shocking for mostly the, you know, the foreigners that come to Iran and see this. You know, it's very interesting for them.
Yeah. Yeah, there's we've heard from some of the victims in a documentary that Press TV had produced, and also the torture survivor who is now one of the tour guides at the museum. He's an elderly man. Yeah.
Yes.
What was it like? Do your parents or any of your older relatives or friends ever describe what Iran was like before the revolution for most people?
Well, from what I've heard from my grandparents and, you know, other people, is that Iran before revolution was like, you know, the present Arab countries like Saudi Arabia. It wasn't like, you know, not letting women drive or things like that. It was just not independent country. For example, the Shah got orders from, you know, the British and the Americans, and we didn't have anything to say in the world. It was just, you know, our natural resources that, you know, were important for the Westerners, and they just, you know, nothing else. You know, they didn't look at us like human beings. It's just a country with very strong natural resources, and they wanted to keep everything calm so they can, you know, take all the resources like what they're doing now with, you know, Arab countries like with Africa. But after the revolution, there were two problems made for the Western countries, especially United States and Britain. And that was, and we didn't give our natural resources for free to them. And also we started awakening other countries. And so the fight against imperialism, you know, as an official fight started. Before that, there were people like in United States, in other countries that they fought, you know, imperialism. But after that, it was official countries. Like, you know, now you see countries like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and now Yemen, you know, and there are many other countries that they stand up against the cruelty of West. So now they don't have the natural resources, and also they're experiencing a country that is awakening other countries and people in the world.
Yeah, and just this past year, Iran was the head of the non-aligned movement, as a matter of fact. That's right.
Yeah. So it really bugs, you know, the Americans. That's why, you know, one of the aims of the nuclear talks these days is that they're trying to limit Iran not to have more influence in the region. If you look at what's happening in the region nowadays, you know, you would see a group of extremists that was made by the United States called ISIS. They wanted ISIS to destroy Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon. But what you see now with the influence of Iran and with the help of Iran, you see that they haven't had any achievement lately in Iraq. And they wanted to attack Lebanon, but they weren't successful. Now they've turned their forces towards Turkey. So whatever Iran wanted in the region has happened, and whatever United States wanted didn't happen, and they just made, you know, things worse than ever.
Yeah. The fight over resources, well, it began maybe in the 19th century, but in Iran, the Shah was installed or reinstalled in power because the Iranian government under Mossadegh wanted to and began to nationalize the oil companies so that the profits from the oil business could be used to develop Iran. And that's why he had to go. And then the Shah brought not just the British back, but also the Americans and the Dutch and others. And that's who benefited from Iran's oil up until 1979. What kind of impact has reacquisition of control over Iran's oil had on the people's living standards there?
Sorry, I didn't get the last part.
In other words, since the revolution, profits from oil are applied to the living standards of the Iranian people instead of to profit columns on Wall Street. What kind of a change has that made for the people?
Don, let me tell you what I've been doing in the past hour. I was interviewing one of the bishops that a group of bishops, six bishops, traveled to Iran to examine the nuclear fatwa of the supreme leader. And they're back for 2 weeks, I think. And I was doing an interview. I asked him, well, this was your first time in Iran and you had an imagination, and but you saw things with your own eye. And he said that Iran is a well-educated, it has well-educated people, and it is very modern, you know, it has very good standard of living. This is the words of an American bishop that, and he saw things for his own eyes. You know, after the revolution, we had a lot of difficulties. There was a revolution, you know, when there is a revolution, you know, things get better after like 30 years, 40 years.
Right.
But exactly after the revolution, we had the 8 years war.
Right.
That Saddam Hussein, with all his allies in the region and Western allies, they attacked Iran for 8 years.
Yeah.
After the war, we had also as we call it, soft war. You know, the American cultural war towards Iran.
Right.
So, despite all these pressures, you know, we see a good quality of living in Iran. And there is like problems in the management and in the ruling, but it's very little comparing to what happened during the Shah in Iran. The Shah in Iran gave like most of the oil and the money to the foreigners, and you know,
right.
You know, just very little enough for people to live. But here we are building infrastructures, we are building, you know, companies, we are building bridges, and we also have a good quality of living here.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.